Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. This week on Ordinary, we're talking about a book in the Bible called Song of Songs. Graham and Mark have preached through this book recently at Christchurch, and so we thought it would make sense to chat through the themes of the book here on Ordinary. It's one of those books that is perhaps less commonly preached in our churches, and maybe that's because our British sensibilities cause us to avoid the potentially awkward moments, or maybe it's because it's hard to see the gospel correlation in its pages, and so we're not sure what to do with it. Well, maybe we can help with that. So sit back, enjoy the podcast, and I'll catch you on the other side.
Hi, I'm Josh Bannister.
Brilliant. Hi, I'm Mark Bentham.
And I'm Graham Nichols, and you're listening to Ordinary.
Well, you may have just been a little bit confused, but we thought, hey, having some fun.
Our regulars will get the jokes.
Let's hope.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
So, welcome back to another episode of Ordinary. Today, we are focusing on the book of Song of Songs. So, if you have children in the car, switch it off.
No, turn it up.
Time. Turn it up. Talk to them about it.
Okay.
We kept saying we're preaching a series in Song of Songs at our church at the moment, and we've kept saying, or I've kept saying, this is suitable for all ages. Mm. Partly because the way we'll speak about it now, and the way we've spoken about it in the sermons, is not so explicit, because the book is not so explicit, right, that a child couldn't cope. But also, let's face it, the children stop listening after a few minutes anyway, so they're switching in and out, and stuff does go over their heads, and that's fine as well. So that works.
But if you're a pastor out there and you want to increase the numbers of your evening service, just preach Song of Songs, because the flocks are coming in.
It's interesting. There's one or two people that have found it a little bit uncomfortable and not there, to be honest. But they're mostly
people are coming out.
There's extra people.
It's been great. Mm. How you found it, Josh? So as a punter.
Yeah, as a punter, I found it interesting. I haven't found it awkward, actually, at any point, to be honest. It's not, we joke about it, don't we? But it's actually fine. We hear a lot worse, see a lot worse on TV and radio and music and all other things like that. So I don't know why we can't talk about it in church. It's quite helpful. And I would say that we're not all the way through the book yet, so it's not like I've got some kind of big overview to give you, but so far I've found it really interesting and helpful, and hopefully you can bring out some of those points during this podcast. I'm going to ask you some questions.
Yeah, go for it.
My first question would be, why is it worth studying and preaching through the book? I think people do assume it's kind of awkward and kind of not massively Jesus-centric. So why have you decided to do a series on Song of Songs?
Well, I think that's interesting. I think that immediately has an interesting presupposition that actually of an agreed understanding of the Song of Songs, which is how we're taking it, in that it is about marriage, intimacy, particularly sexual intimacy, and how men and wives relate. Historically, though, over the years, it's been really talked about not in terms of those kind of language, but much more allegorically, in terms of thinking through Jesus and his relationship with the church. Now, it does speak about that, and it does point us to that, because at the end of the day, marriage is a picture of Christ and his church. But actually, I don't think it primarily has been talking about that. I think primarily it is talking about how we relate as man and wife in marriage.
So in the past, it's been pushed too hard to try and fit into some kind of Jesus-shaped narrative.
Yeah, and I think often that's because perhaps people didn't want the awkwardness of
right.
thinking about what it might mean in its first kind of understanding of it. The sort of metaphors are sort of carefully crafted, not always quite clear what they're about, but they're often about some kind of physical intimacy. And so it's much easier if you sort of go straight from the metaphor to something that's metaphorically speaking about something else. Here's an easy one that's not so awkward to talk about in any sense.
I can see the cogs winding in his head.
There's the earrings. He talks about her earrings at one point, you know, in her ears. And if you go straight to talking about the gold beauty of the word of God that, you know, that goes around every subject and that comes into our ears or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's taking a metaphor of a metaphor kind yes. of thing. But it's quite easy. You know, there's no sure. awkward things to kind of try and unravel about that. I think it's much easier to think, well, in the first place, he was talking about her earrings, you know, and that he likes them and he likes her ears.
Yeah.
Fact.
Mm-hmm.
And he quite likes her.
And what that means. Well, quite so.
okay.
Always, though, although we don't think the sole purpose or even the primary purpose is to talk about Christ in the church explicitly, that the fact of all human relationships reflect relationships within the Trinity that God has and expects us to have, invites us to have, and particularly the man-woman relationship in marriage is always reflecting Christ and his church, God and his people. So you don't take that away. You don't say, well, but just because we're talking about sexual intimacy, it can't possibly be have any connection with Christ. Mm. In terms of the backdrop, the thing that's driving all human relationships is actually the relationship between Christ and his church. And I think you actually get to Christ and the church better that way, rather than trying to go there too quickly or to try and make every little metaphorical thing connect. You understand what it meant, you understand kind of how it applied to human relationships, but then you're always thinking, but ideally the relationship between Christ and his church will do this much so much better. So it's always there.
And I think also it helps you provide the foundation, doesn't it? So and what I mean by that is that actually as we talk about human marriage and then we go to Christ, actually what we begin to see is the ideal. But if I'm trusting in Christ, it then it becomes the foundation then of the marriage as well. It enables me to then do the very things that actually the scriptures are calling me to do yeah. because I'm safe in my relationship with Christ, who is then helping me to do those very things he's calling me to yeah. do as his reflection, as it were.
And so, I think, yeah, just before it gets lost, going back to the question of the why we're doing it,
yeah.
there's the sort of tick-the-box question, which is, well, it's in the Bible,
yeah.
so you want to teach everything that's in the Bible, but we're kind of assuming that. You know, why are we doing songs at this time? I think what we want to do is, without trying to be too right on, we want to redeem the view of sex that's both biblical and positive, and actually speak against the deifying of sex, is saying, you know, it's the most wonderful experience ever in that sort of mystical way, the Hollywood way, the kind of music videos way of sort of putting it out there as something amazing, or denigrate it to some sort of biological production of children or pleasure function
yeah.
that's just a thing that happens. So we want to have a really high view of sex, but not make it God in itself, but have a really high view and speak positively about it. And this having a whole book of the Bible that goes around the area is really helpful to do that. And it's in the context of, it's poetry, so it's not chronological necessarily, but it's in the context of a commitment, an exclusive commitment in marriage between a man and a woman. And there's some really good bits about that as you work your way through in terms of him seeing her or her seeing him as the only one.
Yeah. What struck me, I would say, one of the main things just listening to the sermon so far has been the kind of level of, I guess, sexual freedom and freedom of intimacy and expression within that marriage relationship. So it's not like, because I think a common idea about Christians is that they're kind of prudish or that yeah. they don't, that like you said, sex serves a function yeah. or that if there is pleasure involved, that it's almost like a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
the Song of Songs is preaching against that entirely and say and encouraging within the marriage relationship to completely enjoy one another
yeah.
To the fullest extent.
Yeah. What's really cool is on the wedding night, you got this, it's a bit of a poetical device, but you got the him and the her, and you got the friends. And the friends basically say, go and enjoy yourself on the kind of wedding night. You know, go eat and drink your fill of love and all that sort of thing. I think what's really cool is that there's a discretion about it. They're not wanting to be involved in that, but they're aware and they approve of that. And they're saying it's fine. Now, that's not to say, you know, we should say precisely that at a wedding. Next wedding I go to, I'm going to say, friends, go enjoy your fruits of love and everything. But I think, not just being silly about it, you know, when people get married, you know, if they're Christians who've been seeking to honour God with their bodies before they're married, you know, this is a moment of great excitement and enjoyment and intimacy for them. And not in a crude kind of crass way. We don't say, oh, go on, you know, but we do say, this is great. You know, enjoy that. Enjoy the whole of your life together, but enjoy that sexual union as an expression of your unity and as a way of actually maintaining that unity. And we do that and then we withdraw. So we don't talk endlessly about sex with our, you know, with other married couples. You know, how is it for you? How is it for me? And all that sort of thing. I think that's entering a private area that we shouldn't, but just being aware and approve and not being just so, I don't know, denying about it.
Sure.
You know, sometimes there's a kind of weird denial that people, you know, in our church are actually having sex, some of them, some of the time. There's a kind of assumption. I know we know it's not true, but there's a kind of weird surprise almost when babies are produced and we think, oh yeah, I suppose not literally surprised.
Yes.
What I mean is we don't need to talk about it a lot, but we just need to approve and be aware and say it's a good thing.
Yeah.
But I think as well, one of the joys, and it connects as well with what David Robertson was saying on one of the earlier podcasts in terms of speaking into the culture, isn't it? So we live in a highly sexualized culture.
Yeah.
Everything is sold around sex pretty much. It's in our faces all the time. So actually, we want to be speaking, okay, how does the Bible talk about such things in a way that honours and glorifies Christ? And in one sense, what we're saying is, no, we want to redeem it, because actually this is God's design and God's purpose, and this is how we want it to be seen, not as it's being portrayed, often wrongly, smutty, outside of covenant relationship, and actually just bringing it back to what it is.
Mm.
But how does Song of Songs talk about it? Sexual intimacy. How does it talk about it?
Well, firstly, within marriage.
Yeah.
So the way the book is, chapter 5, verse 1, is the kind of the marriage night.
Mm-hmm.
And leading up to that point is their kind of romancing, wooing of one another, poetic language,
expectation,
expressing the desire. But then it's kind of spoken of in kind of poetic, beautiful language that kind of is expressing the kind of the deep intimacy that comes about as a result of our sexual union, as it were. So it speaks about it in those ways. But interestingly, the book doesn't then just kind of, it's not all about sex.
Mm.
In one sense, it's then kind of works out, okay, what happens after that? So the very next verse after the marriage night is kind of suggesting a little bit further forward in their relationship. The husband comes home late. Mm. He's knocking on the door. He's, you know, seeking to woo his wife, and she, 5 verse 3, starts to give excuses of why she does not want to be intimate with him at that point. You know, don't want to get out of bed. You know, I'm washed, clean. And then, you know, she then moves towards him. But by that point, he's gone. He's emotionally withdrawn. She then starts to, you know, go back after him, trying to woo him, you know, speaking words of affirmation. You know, then you get they get together again, but then actually you see him expressing depths of forgiveness, and then you're seeing how the realities of how they know each other and addressing some of the issues that happen within marriages and within the context of intimacy. So it is much more than just sex, but actually that's kind of how one then speaks about that and rekindling that.
Yeah, and it talks about body parts, but actually, when it comes to, let's be honest about it, the sexual organs, it's pretty discreet to the point of never. in an explicit way. Some of the commentators get a bit excited about, you know, what's this a metaphor for?
A bit excited.
And you think, come on, get a life. It doesn't really matter. I think there's a studied, you know, exact discretion about it. Studied as in, you know, planned discretion. You know, it's poetry.
Everyone knows what it's referring to. You don't have to be a genius.
But even everyone knows what it's referring to, as in, okay, they're obviously getting sexually intimate at this point. It's not described in such a way that it's, okay, this is what biologically is happening. And I think that's a great example to us as a sort of by the way, in that there is some degree of discretion and not crudity about it. But with a sort of clear understanding of what's going on. So I think it's discreet in the way it talks about it.
Absolutely. And
I think we've tried to be as well in the way we've preached it so far.
You could ruin that in the next few.
But yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I found it really interesting in the last chapter that we did, which was what, 5?
Yes.
When the woman is describing, and also the man has done this, but describing her husband as kind of the one and only, and she describes his form with different precious stones and metals and different things. And I was thinking, okay, that's really interesting. To what extent do we, should we be concerned with our physical appearance and maintaining our attractiveness to our spouse? Like, should that be something that we can think about? Because I was thinking when we were listening to that section being read, I was thinking, man, this guy must have been like hench, like maybe he has like arms like gold and like legs like cedars. This is a strong guy. This isn't a guy sitting on the sofa with a beer belly watching TV with peanuts by his side. Like, that's not the attractive picture that's being that's being made. Like, how far can we take that? Do we need to be going to the gym, guys, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm smiling because I didn't have a beer, but I had some peanuts last night. I was sitting on the sofa watching something.
I think what you're raising is a really interesting point. I think there is a whole discussion about care of our bodies.
Mm.
But actually, I think it's more is she is delighting in her husband. And she loves him for who he is and how he is. So I think it's much more that what we're trying to encourage is for the wife here is delighting in her husband's body. And she's using kind of language that is romantic and poetic to describe him.
Yeah.
It's exaggerated as well.
Exaggerated. And then actually what we're going to see this coming Sunday, Josh, is how the husband describes the wife.
Mm-hmm.
In kind of her body, he delights in it. He's then speaking about, you know, how he just enjoys her. And he's using highly sensual, erotic language in one sense to describe her. Now, that's between a husband and a wife. Now, I think there is something where we probably don't affirm one another and use that kind of language, as I'll say this Sunday, about how we speak to our wife. You know, often I think blokes, we just go, you know, yeah, you look nice, dear. But actually, here the Bible is kind of saying, no, use language, kind of express your delight in. So does it matter that therefore, should I be attractive to my, make an effort? Yes. Does that mean I have to go to the gym to get a six pack? No. But my wife and my, you know, and husband are supposed to delight in each other as they are, as it were. And I think that's the key. That's the foundation, as it were, rather than the go and get buffed up.
Yeah, because it would lack application in later years as well, I suppose, if that were the case. You want to say I'm assuming that this is applicable across a long marriage.
Absolutely.
I think though it works. I agree with you really, Mark, but just to say it again in a slightly different way, I do think that there is not so much an obligation, but if we love our husband or wife, we will want to try at times to look our best. There is a kind of an acceptance. Absolutely. that we don't always have to do that, so we don't have to dress up for them. But if we never make an effort, we are kind of making a statement to them, you're not important. Mm. And especially if, you know, if we go out with our mates, we make sure we look smart.
Right.
You know, we've shaved and cleaned our teeth or whatever.
I hope you do that anyway, to be honest.
Yeah, but the shaving part. Did I shave this morning? Yeah, I did shave this morning, but I thought about not, because I thought, I'm not sure I'm seeing anyone that important today.
I see. That's our level, is it?
I didn't shave.
Did you not?
Yeah. No, but let's not go.
But anyway, the point is, you would make an effort. And I think if you understand what your partner likes, what your spouse likes, in terms of, you know, clothing. You're not going to go out of your way to wear something they hate. You know, they think you look stupid in it. They think you look like a sack of potatoes or whatever. But I think it mostly the poetry is about idealizing. And there's a really good bit earlier on, which I think is in some of Mark's texts as well. But it's the idea that you're the one.
Yeah.
And so I think in one of the texts I preached, it talked about a lily amongst the thistles, or an apple tree amongst some
the
other
forest.
Trees,
yeah,
forest.
Yeah.
So in both cases, man and woman, they're looking at each other and they're saying, you're the one, you're exclusive.
Yeah.
It's obvious, if you just make it about men and women, there will be loads of other good-looking women and good-looking men, attractive in character, around.
Yeah.
But you're saying, in my eyes, you are the one who's the lily and all the other guys are thistles. Or all the other girls.
And that's an active choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
definitely.
Not based on feelings.
Well,
I
suppose it's complicated to unravel that, but it's part of the feelings and the commitment that have all bound together in a relationship of love where you both feel that, but you also commit to carrying on feeling that and to disciplining your kind of thought life and what you speculate on in order to keep that going.
Yeah.
And I think
and I did speculate, sorry, a little bit on kind of old people. I kind of mentioned it more as a thought exercise in one of the talks I was giving, to think, you know, how does that pan out when you get older? You still should be finding the other person attractive. Now, it's obvious when you're, you know, 70, 80 year old, maybe you're in a care home by this time, certainly into your 90s, you can't possibly objectively say, you know, my husband is this stacked hench is the word, person.
Whatever you want.
You know, it's a big step of idealizing to do that. But still, he's the one. And,
sure.
You know, some of the sweetest kind of things are people who are, you know, elderly, who still obviously have an affection for each other. It's
yes.
It's not just a mind commitment. It's a heart thing as well.
Yes.
And they still do find the other person attractive. You know, even with all their wrinkles and their walking stick and everything else,
yeah.
They're still finding something attractive about that person. And distinctive from all the other people.
And I think that's where the character's shaped, isn't it? Because sometimes the stackness, as it were, it's not so much about... It's more
stackness,
about,
we're having a new word
it's,
now.
It's the security that is, you know, the wife is expressing, that my husband is mine and he's my protector and security. And the wife, you know, the husband's talking about the wife in terms of she's mine, she's the one I love and treasure and, you know, he talks about my little dove.
And you also make the... You didn't have a West Country accent.
Well, I just felt that they did when they're talking about my dove.
But what was I going to say? You make your wife or your husband the standard of beauty. And so you use the categories that are general to do with beauty, but you also apply it to them. So, you know, if they've got blonde hair, you like blonde hair. You know, what kind of hair do you like? Blonde hair. You can't have a wife who's got blonde hair and you like red hair. I suppose you get to dye it. But, you know, for the time that they are that, that's what you like. So you make her the standard for beauty and kind of the other way around.
Yeah.
And you know, if that's what you like, then that's what you continue to like as you get older. You know, do I like younger women, older women? Well, it depends who I'm married to. You know, I like the woman I'm married to. That's my standard. That's what I want to see around.
And I think that is part of the issue of the culture we live in is that what's happening is that, and I think particularly this is true of guys, that they're looking elsewhere.
For the standard.
Yeah. You know, pornography.
Yeah.
They're seeing the billboards, they're seeing the adverts, and they're looking at, let's be honest, often airbrushed and unnatural.
Yeah.
And saying that's the standard. Whereas actually, and I think this is what Song of Songs is so good, is that actually all the language, I mean, who knows what? You know, we assume it's Solomon, but it might not be. I mean, he may have just been a scrawny little shepherd boy, you know, and she's delighting in him. And I think it is that sense of our wives or our husbands become that standard of beauty. And I might see things, but actually it's irrelevant because actually who I deeply love is my wife or my husband, and they're the one, which is why I think all this using of the language and speaking these words and affirming all these things are all part of it, more than actually we allow. So I think we too often just go into our normal, you know, busyness of life. We get tired, you know, the seasons of life, kids come along, and we stop trying to make effort to woo our woo our husbands or our wives in how we look, but in how we speak, how we're affirming. You know, not just, well, you look nice. Yeah, that looks all right. Or, yeah, I love you. But actually thinking, being creative, you know, knowing how they are, knowing them well enough to be able to affirm them properly. And one of the things that's going to come out this Sunday is actually often we think it all starts by, well, you'll have great sex. If you have great sex, then you'll carry on. But actually, sex flows out of loving one another well. If we love one another well, the sexual intimacy will grow. It doesn't work the other way around.
Sure.
And I think that's the...
Yeah, it doesn't work in the other way around in that sense, but they're interrelated, aren't they? So
absolutely.
So the one reinforces the other.
Sure.
And so you can't say, well, I have a great sex life, but I have a terrible relationship. Mm. But you also can't say, I have a great relationship, but I have a terrible sex life. That doesn't make sense, because if you have a great relationship, you'll figure out how to have a good sex life. And you need to kind of work on both, and they interact with each other as well. I mean, fundamentally, it's the relationship flows into the sex. It's an expression of it, but I think it's always helpful to think about it also as a reinforcing of that union and a sort of a kind of acting out in a way of that union. And as you're going to say on Sunday, I think, or maybe you said last Sunday, it works out in how you perform, for want of a better word, not a very suitable one maybe, in the bedroom is actually how you're going to perform in the relationship generally. So, you know, at the fundamental level, if you're selfish in the bedroom, you're probably going to be selfish in the relationship. You know, if you're selfish, demanding, irritable, very narrow-minded, then that's how you're going to be in the relationship, and vice versa.
The bedroom is just one context of the marriage, isn't it? A part of it. Now, there may be some edge cases. I just think when you were saying, if you have a great relationship but a terrible sex life, well, there may be medical reasons for that. Yeah. So just, you know, clarify that it's not 100%.
But I think the great relationship even figures out
how we can express that in the best way.
Yeah. Sure.
And I think that's where we're trying to, and I think that's what's great about the Song of Songs. At the end of the day, although it talks a lot about sex, it's actually much more about how you build a deeper, intimate marriage relationship. Now, of course, for those who have been part of the service who are single, of course, either it's looking maybe towards when they will be married, but for others, it is also speaking about how we relate to one another as well. So lots of this stuff has overlap in just our everyday relationships. You know, am I selfish? Am I, you know, encouraging? Am I affirming? You know, how does it connect to my relationship with Christ? How does that then help me to serve others? So it makes other connections as well. I can imagine people listening, oh, well, it's not for me. It does, because it's shaping about relationships and how we live
always
those
there.
Out.
The God and his people bit is always there.
Absolutely.
As we're going through it. So we're excited about the book, and we're glad that we're able to preach it, but we'd encourage people to read it and to apply it, and for any preachers listening to think about preaching it.
Well, and if you're not part of Christchurch and you want to listen, all of our sermons are online. You're welcome to go along to cchh.org.uk, and all the sermons are published. Listen up and then feedback. Tell us what you think.
Well, thanks for joining us for another Ordinary. If you have questions on this week's podcast or something you've heard in the past, or if you want to suggest topics for our future podcasts, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us on ordinary@cchh.org.uk. As Mark mentioned, if you wanted to listen to the Song of Songs series that Graham and Mark recently preached, you can head over to cchh.org.uk. All of the sermons will be streamable from that website. Next week on the podcast, we have Helen Thorne. So definitely subscribe so that you don't miss out on that. And please do keep sharing the podcast with your friends and family. That would be brilliant. Catch you next week for another brand new episode of Ordinary.